today on Edinburgh Radio News. We take a visit to a robot battleground where many will enter, but only one will leave. Good afternoon from the University of Southern California, and welcome to Edinburgh Radio News for March 11th, 2014. I'm Anna Yukar. The Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors voted today to form a strike force to go after local toxic polluters. As Daniel Carr Crawford reports, the supervisors are frustrated that state regulatory agencies did not stop a battery plant from serial polluting. The board wants the plant shut down.
Prior to now, the state of California had controlled the regulation of factory pollution. Supervisor Molina has been trying to push this issue into the forefront of Los Angeles' consciousness for years, but has consistently found problems. The strike teams will be made up of public health officials, lawyers, and other county employees. John Hogarth, manager of the Exite plant in Vernon, is convinced that his company is doing all it needs to lower its pollution output.
For some reason, every time I took a vacation and I stayed home for at least a week, I would end up getting sick with a sinus problem. When I retired, I became very ill with respiratory problems. Well, it's the environment. Please, look at each person that is being affected. Over 200,000 families. My brother has cancer. Please, look at that.
Prior to now, the state of California had controlled the regulation of factory pollution. Supervisor Molina has been trying to push this issue into the forefront of Los Angeles' consciousness for years, but has consistently found problems. The strike teams will be made up of public health officials, lawyers.
We have been trying every which way to get state agencies to operate and function and to at least go after them in some fashion. Exide has a temporary permit. It's had a temporary permit for five decades. And very frankly, they aren't moving forward to at least clean up, so now we've created the strike team that is going to go after them.
The strike teams will be made up of public health officials, lawyers, and other county employees. John Hogarth, manager of the Exite plant in Vernon, is convinced that his company is doing all it needs to lower its pollution output.
The company will have spent $20 million since 2010. Most of that investment has been to reduce emissions and to improve our environmental footprint. We have seen about a 95% reduction in arsenic since April of 2013, and that's a report that came out from AQMD, so that's their quotation.
Molina and community officials will not stop until companies such as Exide are regulated or removed entirely.
At the end of the day, there were arsenic levels that were found in our parks, in 85 residences right near the area. And very frankly, when you look at the health threat overall, you know, I don't know what they can stand behind. I'd like to know why they've been operating for five generations on a temporary permit. They cannot meet the standards.
The motion passed today in the Board of Supervisors meeting, and community members and policymakers alike are eager to see the plan's implementation. Daniel Carr Crawford, Edinburgh Radio News.
The Los Angeles area woman who gave birth to octuplets in 2009 could face jail time. Nadia Suleiman, known as Octomom, has 14 children in all. She pleaded not guilty today in a welfare fraud case. Suleiman filed for public assistance last year, but prosecutors say she failed to report all of her earnings. Suleiman appeared in a pornographic film in 2012 and has posed topless for several publications to earn money. Prosecutors say she owes the state $26,000. The hit show Cops is celebrating their 25th year anniversary today. Christina Savon has the story behind the show's popular theme song.
Bad boys, what you want, what you want, what you gonna do?
Roger Lewis from the Jamaican band Inner Circle had no idea his group's Bad Boys song would revolutionize the way people think of the word cops.
Bad boys, bad boys. In 1989, while we were sitting in Florida, in Miami, and a man came and said he was making a docudrama. And he wanted a little reggae song. I thought it was just a little docudrama thing that he was going to make and it was going to come on television one time and gone.
One of the show's creators, Malcolm Barber, approached Inner Circle to do the theme song.
He came down to Miami, and we gave him a cassette tape at that time, cassette. And he went away, and we thought we never heard from this man again. And about a month later, he came back and said he would like to incorporate this song into his docudrama thing that he's doing.
I talked to some USC students about the show, and here's what one student had to say.
I just remember, like, the bad boys, what you gonna do?
What you gonna do when they come for you?
Christina Savon, Annenberg Radio News.
Sporting events are always a big draw here at USC, but it's not so often you get to see the people that make those sports possible. As Andy Vassoyan reports, the story of the fundraiser behind USC's athletics is just as interesting as the sports themselves.
The name Don Winston might not be a name you're familiar with, even if you're familiar with USC. Winston's not a newly elected chancellor, or a failed football coach, or a Nobel Prize-winning physicist. But in the 40 years Winston's worked for the university, he's helped turn USC into a powerhouse of college sports, and he did it by using other people's money to pay the bills.
Our endowment when I came in was $2.5 million, total endowment, and now it's $145 million. Our income is about $8 million a year.
All those millions might seem like a lot of money, but Winston says there's always a need.
It's not unreasonable for a private school to have $13 to $15 million a year they have to pay out. Then we have the capital on the other side of the coin. The capital is to raise the money for Heritage Hall renovation, for the new swim stadium, for the new McKay Center. It's a lot of money for us to raise.
And that's where Winston comes in. When the USC basketball stadium over on Figueroa and Jefferson was being built, he sold the naming rights to the building to Lou Gehlen for $10 million. He sold the floor to another donor for $5 million. He sold the seat sections for up to $1 million, and the seats themselves for up to $10,000. Here's Winston on how he sold the stadium to Gehlen in the first place.
I took him to the Heisman Trophy, and he said that was the greatest time of his life, other than marrying his wife. And the next morning we had breakfast, and he said, Don, I had a wonderful time, and I'd like to give $10 million to start the arena. And I told him, well, I'll buy you breakfast.
Don had already become a fundraising maverick by then, though. His biggest success was in the late 90s when
I started the program, and we were the first ones to do that in the country, to endow the football team, to endow the tackle at that time, or the guard, or whatever. So we were really successful, because no one had ever done it.
That tactic should be named the Winston, but it's not. But it's now pretty much standard in all college teams across the country. Years later, and after all his success, which include a Lifetime Achievement Award and his very own wing in a building, Don Winston's 40-year stay at the university is coming to an end. His longtime friend, law professor John Kotler, says rumors of his retirement have been greatly exaggerated.
As I understand it, the deal he's got with the athletic department is he's going to be a consultant. It's probably the best deal the athletic department ever made, because you're not going to keep Don away. I mean, as long as he's physically able to get down here, he'll get down here, because this is where his heart is.
Either way, if you're ever walking around Gehlen Center or Locker Stadium or the Mud Building, Heritage Hall, the Physics Lab, McKay Stadium, or any of the other countless buildings that Don Winston helped pay for, maybe you should think a bit about making a donation. Andy Vassoyan, Annenberg Radio News.
Temperatures will cool down tonight to the mid-50s, but will heat back up tomorrow to a high of 79 degrees with sunny skies. The sunshine will carry over into Thursday, settling down into the mid-70s with partial clouds. Later on Annenberg Radio News, we hear from KCRW's Jason Bentley about whether South by Southwest is really even cool anymore. If you've ever had a bad experience with the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti hopes he has the answer. This morning, he was at City Hall to discuss his solutions for improving DWP. Andrea Martinez has the story.
If you are one of the hundreds of thousands of Angelenos who were overcharged by the Department of Water Power's new billing system, be prepared to chill out for about half hour if you plan to call the company's customer service line to complain. At least that's what new Westside resident Kalia had to do when she tried to get service online.
There was a message that it'll process the order and contact me if there's any question.
After not hearing back, she tried online again. Still no response.
And I decided to call, and it was only to find out that the wait time is over 82 minutes.
Wow, 82 minutes. Mayor Eric Garcetti has little patience for this.
So I'm determined not just to fix what's wrong, but to go a step beyond that and to make this good again. Our most immediate goal is to fix the billing problems that came to when the department installed a new billing system, got hundreds of calls. My own father, I remember calling me one day saying, I was on hold for more than 40 minutes. What's going on?
His new general manager, Marcy Edwards, got the message.
Bear in mind, this billing system, in all honesty, should have been replaced 20 years ago. It's almost 40 years old.
The old billing system was replaced with a new one last September, and since then, wait times have gotten longer and incorrect bills have been sent out to frustrated customers, like Emily of West Los Angeles, who received a $3,500 bill in December when her average bill is just $30. But before the department could ever make customers happy again, Garcetti says building the city's trust in the agency is crucial.
We are going to restore pride in this utility. We are going to restore pride that you feel. Pride that the workers feel, pride that our city lawmakers feel.
And in the meantime, waiting customers can hang up the phone because Garcetti has already hired 50 new representatives and implemented a callback system, which calls you back instead of having to wait hours on the line. Andrea Martinez, Annenberg Radio News.
A robot battle royale took place today on the Caltech campus. Sean Birch went to check it out.
Caltech does more than just lose basketball games in their gymnasium. Okay, that was harsh, but the gym was packed for a different kind of competition. Six teams competed in an intricate robot war today. Rob Morgan, who helped organize the event, explains the competition.
There are four ramps in the middle leading up to a 5-foot-tall platform, and the objective is to get the can, the soup can, empty soup can, as close as possible to the center of that top platform. So ideally this involves making it up one of the ramps or flying with some sort of device and landing on the top, but also you can win by just being closest on the floor surrounding the ramps.
Monica Enlow from Team 40-Piece Chicken McNuggets talked about her group's preparation.
We've been working on this since the beginning of October. We've gone through multiple trials, multiple robots, and even 2 weeks ago we had two completely different robots.
James Chung, a high school student visiting the campus, talked about the view from the crowd.
I think it's a little interesting, and I think it does make Caltech a little unique, which makes me want to go there a little more.
The highlight of the event was when our flying robot went crashing into the crowd. No one was injured. Sean Birch, Annenberg Radio News.
The opera world recently lost one of its visionaries. Gerard Mortier died this weekend. As a company director, he is credited with helping updating opera. Jasmine White is studying at USC's Thornton School of Music. Here is Jasmine in her own words.
Well, I haven't warmed up yet. I'm Jasmine. I like to sing opera. One day I auditioned for chamber singers in my high school choir, and the teacher said, "Oh, I think you have a lot of potential. Why don't you take lessons?" I was just so offended. I was like, "I'm not going to take lessons. That's just for people who aren't good enough." But then I started taking lessons, and I wanted to be like Beyonce, you know, to be a pop singer.
The sky is clouded. Hark! Hark! A wound rends the mountain looks asunder.
I try to warm up every day, but I don't sing more than that every day. It can be exhausting on your vocal cords. The most exciting part would definitely be the in-performance mode that you get in. because you're not thinking about the notes on the page and you're not thinking about the music that you've practiced. It's really the world that you've created every day you go in there and you think new emotions and new feelings, and then they all sort of come together at the performance moment. And that's, it's just like a different world.
That sound portrait was produced by Ella Bernal. The Statue of Liberty, the Lincoln Memorial, and the Hollywood sign are all historic landmarks that have shaped the culture of our society. But what about the less iconic landmarks that hold significance for a community? Dr. Ned Kaufman, a heritage preservationist, joined me in the studio earlier to discuss that very question.
People form very deep emotional attachments to the places they live. And the reason they're attached to those places has nothing to do with the fact that they're aesthetically exceptional or extraordinary. It has to do with the fact that they're home, that they live there, that they're familiar, and that their identity and their sense of their own evolving life, their biography, is rooted there.
How do we justify which areas of significance? How do we identify or, you know, prioritize which ones should be preserved and which ones should not be?
This is a very interesting problem that you've put your finger on, because what we find is that people's attachment to places is very subjective. It's not based on objective criteria. It's based on their own life story. So I think what we need to do is not to look at individual cases, not to base our policy on preserving this person's special place or that person's special place, but to get a better understanding of what kinds of places are important in people's lives, and then to develop broad policies that will help protect those places in general from harm and destruction.
What kind of psychological impact do you think conserving these areas would have on community members?
The first thing to look at is the impact that destroying them has on community members. And unfortunately, we have a lot of experience with that. Back in from the 1950s through the early 1970s, roughly, we had all of the programs that were known as urban renewal. And unfortunately, those programs displaced about 1 million people in the United States from their homes, mainly by destroying their neighborhoods. And those urban renewal programs gave psychiatrists an opportunity to study what happened to people when you either ripped them out of their homes or destroyed their homes. And the findings were very disturbing. People felt physically sick. Many of them never, and emotionally heart sore, and many of them never recovered. And these findings have been duplicated again and again.
If you had one thing you could say to policymakers, lawmakers, what would it be, and why should they care?
Think about people. In preservation, we're usually thinking about buildings, places, physical things. We often use the word resource, the bloodless, colorless word resource, to describe the things that we're trying to save. We should be thinking always about people. We protect places because of the benefits they provide to people. So that would be the one thing I would say. Always think of the people.
Dr. Ned Kaufman, principal of Kaufman Heritage Conservation. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Film, tech, music, these are the three cornerstones of South by Southwest, the multimedia festival that is taking over Austin, Texas once again. The festival features up-and-coming talent and established names like KCRW. The public radio station has gone to South by for years. Graham Clark and Lillian Min discover how the station is adapting and what weirdness still lies in the heart of Austin.
My name is Jenny Radulet, and I'm a producer at KCRW. I produce The Treatment, which is a weekly show, and I also run KCRW's independent producer project.
Thank you for entertaining that.
Okay,
I was going to ask you exactly what we're hearing. So that was a toilet sound, I believe. That's the sound of a toilet?
Yep.
Okay, I wanted to be clear, nailing that down.
Yep. I'm in a bathroom right now of a bar. like part of the experience, right?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
there aren't that many quiet places. This bar is the location of the very first Bitcoin ATM that was ever installed in Austin.
Wow.
So you walk in and it's this super, you know, kind of hipster dive bar, and it's called the Handlebar, and a lot of the bartenders have these like big handlebar mustaches. That scene in and of itself kind of encapsulates South by Southwest. This weird amalgam of like, you know, indie culture and pop culture and innovation.
Austin's whirlwind atmosphere is still a place of discovery, but for some, it's harder and harder to sort through all the noise. For instance, the host of KCRW's Morning Becomes Eclectic.
Jason Bentley, music director, KCRW in Santa Monica. I am in Austin at South by Southwest. For me, it seems like South by is a little bit at a tipping point with these massive tech brands and lifestyle brands and products like Doritos. Mm-hmm. It's really obnoxious, but it's impossible to really compete with the Yahoo and the Samsung and the Doritos and everything. So that's not really the goal. We're at a place with the industry changes in the record business and such where it's kind of a necessary evil. There's just a lot. There's too many people here and too much mm-hmm. going on. So it feels like almost Austin is unable to properly manage it at a certain point. I mean, as an observer, as someone who's come here every year, it seems like they could do a better job at just public transit, organization. Mm. They've got some work to do.
Are you going to be coming back next year? Is there going to be a 2015?
I will. Yeah, I will. I mean, it's just too important to what we do. But, I mean, it is really way too crowded.
There was a bar that burned down yesterday, right? There was no one in it, but already one building has gotten taken out. Did you hear about that at all?
I didn't, actually. That's right. Kind of funny.
I think it's true. I was hoping to get the confirmation from you, but no one was injured, as I heard. sorry if it's morbid. Have you figured out some sort of recipe at this point since you've seen South by Southwest over the years? Do you have some sort of secret formula that's like not...
secret sauce.
It's kind of a science. I mean, you have to work the right channel. I would estimate we're a good year ahead of the mainstream. But South by Southwest is definitely an important part of that. It's an opportunity for me to essentially check under the hood, you know, like see what they got. I think as far as like who we pick, it's based on a few, you know, leading indicators, whatever might hint at a group building a story. You know, bands often tell me like, well, how do I get my music on KCRW? And honestly, I want to find you. I don't really want the band to push something on me. I mean, that's automatically not ideal. I want to stay in touch with, you know, my 16-year-old self that's just excited in a very pure way about music. So that same sort of voracious appetite for what's new and what's happening. And, you know, I think for me personally, it is about jumping into the fray and really checking out as much music as possible.
Can I ask you, what's the band that 16-year-old you is most excited to see? Is there anything that stands out that 16-year-old you is just going to go?
Well, I really like this album from The War on Drugs. They're a band out of Philadelphia. I do think one of the artists on our showcase tomorrow, Moses Sumney, has a bright year ahead.
Why do you come here? Why do you tear me apart?
Check out KCRW's South by Southwest Music Showcase tomorrow online at kcrw.com.
Graham Clark, Annenberg Radio News.
Lillian Min, Annenberg Radio News. Why do you
love me? Now it's time to hear the sounds of another place that's uniquely Los Angeles.
My name is Lillian Afonso, and I am like, you can put a cashier for the recycling, yeah. We have customers that they're here every day. Usually they do two trips. You know, these people that does this type of work, they get up really early, like 3 a.m., 4 a.m., and they go out looking for their metal. You know, they go to constructions to see what can they find, and usually they do two trips a day, which they make pretty good money.
Sonic City!
Today marks the 3-year anniversary of the natural disaster that hit Fukushima, Japan. It caused the damage to nuclear power plants that spilled radioactive waste into the ocean. As Camille Riquesas found, the effects of these natural disasters were so tremendous that people in California are still affected by the event today.
It's been 3 years since the Fukushima nuclear meltdown in Japan. Douglas Erber, president of the Japan-America Society of Southern California, says that it wasn't only Japan that was affected.
I think it affected all Americans. It affected the entire world, seeing some of the graphic, unfathomable images that we saw live.
Erber also says the Japanese-American relationship is strong, and many people did whatever they could to help during the tragedy.
One gentleman was telling me that everybody on the ship was giving all of their personal clothes that they possibly could to donate just for so that when the helicopters were taking food and other supplies over to the devastated areas, they were also taking clothing from the Navy seamen and seawomen.
Today, Japan is still reeling from the incident, and the local U.S.-Japanese community here is trying to find ways to help the most stricken regions. The Japan-American Society is raising funds for orphanages in Fukushima and towards a community center that will be used as a relief center in case something like the disaster ever happens again.
And 100% of the funds that we receive are being sent directly to nonprofits in Japan that are on the front lines of immediate relief and long-term recovery.
The effects from the nuclear incident in Japan have rolled across the Pacific and are beginning to show up here in California. Stephen Manley from California State University Long Beach is joining over 40 other marine scientists to research the possible levels in radiation in kelp along the western coast. He calls this research project Kelp Watch 2014.
Kelp Watch 2014 is a scientific campaign that utilizes our coastal kelp beds to detect the projected arrival and presence of radioisotopes and seawater that are coming over from Fukushima.
Manley does say, however, if they do find some levels of radiation, it will not be anything to worry about.
We do not think it will be a human health risk, but we think it's important that we know exactly how much material is present and exactly how much material gets into our West Coast kelp forests, because the kelp forests are the basis of a highly productive and very complex ecosystem.
There's been long-lasting impacts from the Japan disaster here. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission has reassessed SPIRD safety planning in 100 nuclear plants operating in the U.S. Camille, Annenberg Radio News.
Did your phone go off with a noisy Amber Alert yesterday? The missing child is safe, but the woman behind the alert is facing criminal charges today. Sheree Ann Johnson picked up her 12-year-old son, Nicholas, for her visitation on March 5th, but did not return him to school as scheduled the next day. Police issued the Amber Alert yesterday afternoon. They found Nicholas an hour later in Oceanside. He has since been reunited with his father. Now we check in with Ben Capinos to see what's coming up on Annenberg TV News at 6 p.m. on Trojan Vision.
Well, our women of Troy on the basketball court in Seattle had a terrific run through the Pac-12 tournament, and now they're back. So we've got player reactions and more tonight on ATVN.
Wow, big news coming out of that girls' gym locker. Thanks again, Ben. We're looking forward to it. That's it for this Tuesday. Our production assistant is Lexi McAvinci. Graham Clark produces our arts and culture segment, and the newscast producer is Andy Vasoyan. Our executive producer is Catherine Davis. And for all of us here at Annenberg Radio News, I'm Anna Yukar.